Welcome. We're on the red couch with Scott Osborne, creator and producer of Spoiled, a play about violence and masculinity in India and the USA. Scott has worked to help teens, women, boys, and girls achieve more equitable and fulfilling lives in Asia, Africa, Russia, and the U.S. for over 30 years. She currently focuses on education, gender equality, advocacy, and policy work with NGOs. Her international nonprofit work includes designing and managing maternal child health programs in Kenya and evaluating NGO grant proposals in India and Africa. Scott, I'm thrilled to have you on the red couch.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So you lived in India.
Yes.
From 2011. Through
2014, I moved back.
Okay.
Actually, I've been back and forth again this year, but I stopped living there full-time in 2014.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me about your experience living there and how that informed Spoiled.
Sure. When I went in 2011, I wasn't exactly sure I was going to focus on this, but I was really struck by the position of women and girls living in India. This is the seventh country I'd lived in, so I had a little perspective going around. And I was just struck by what it was like to be a woman. And I started researching, started working with some women's groups, knowing I'd probably do a book or an article. I wasn't sure what it was going to become. Didn't realize it would become a play.
Right.
And all of the material just kept accumulating. And I had a chance meeting with a wonderful actress and playwright, Elizabeth Hess, in 2012. And we started to collaborate and realized this could really be some dramatic material. So that's the very short version of how it came about. It did not start being a play, but I'm thrilled it became that.
So there's 10 stories.
10 stories. 6 based in India, 4 based in the U.S. And what was interesting about these stories is we did not want to make them up. We took them from real life. We took them from news articles. We took them from actual events that had occurred. And decided we did not just want to look at the female perspective. These all had to do with gender violence, but we wanted to get out of a victim-centered approach. We felt it was really important to see what was happening to men and boys. And so we shifted the lens for all 10 of these stories.
So all 10 of the stories, the perspective is from the male perspective.
It's from a male perspective, either in some cases the perpetrator, sometimes a father, sometimes a boy. But it is from the male perspective because we started to say, there's two parties involved here. You know, how are we all creating men and boys who become violent? That's really the question that informed this. We wanted to say it's not just about the victim. It's about what we are doing in America and India, but we, as members of society, how are we creating these men and boys? So that was really what drove that male perspective.
So what are a couple of examples of the...
Sure. Well, in India, one thing that's a big problem is infanticide. Girls are a burden on many families. There's a dowry system so that if you have girls, you essentially have to pay for them to be married, and then they go work in another family. So for very poor people, it's a huge burden.
Right.
So if you have many girls, this can totally bankrupt families. And it's a very poignant situation, and obviously it's indefensible, but it's something that we actually empathized with. And so one of the scenes has to do with a father who kills his infant daughter. And that's a hard thing to watch a portrayal. It's a hard thing to think about, but it happens. And it's interesting to understand the position of this man who's totally impoverished and the burden of bearing another daughter because of his society. That's one example. In the U.S., we looked, one example has to do with military and sexual assaults in the military, which, if you've been reading the newspapers, is a very common problem.
Yeah, right.
One website I was reading estimates, very credible, that 26,000 service people are assaulted in the military in 2012. That's a huge number.
This is
so,
the U.S.
In the U.S., mm-hmm. just in the U.S. So this is one of the U.S. stories. So we found a report of about a family, about a young woman who was killed, who first was raped and then through some violent circumstances was killed. And we told the story from her father, who had also been in the military, and the poignancy and the heartbreak for him. His daughter was a lesbian and he felt she was attacked and she was raped, and it was very unpleasant. But it really portrays the perspective from another man in that situation. This was from the perspective of the father. And a lot of people found that very heart-wrenching.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
So, through your research, what were some of the shocking responses to when you were asking, why do boys, mm-hmm. not just men, but mm-hmm. boys, rape?
Right. I started researching first in Asia, and obviously, some of these statistics are hard to get at, but more and more agencies, the UN, some very reputable agencies, are starting to do survey reports. And one of the best and most interesting I found was why this violence occurs. It had to do with 10 countries in Asia, and they did very large-scale surveys. And the shocking thing that I really had to put down the report and think about it was the most common reason was what men called the sense of entitlement, which is what they called the because they could, and the other reason is because they were bored or it was fun. So I said to myself, wait a minute, there's some very violent activities going on here, this men and boys raping people because they feel entitled or because it's fun. There's something wrong with this picture. So this, wow, this really sort of messes with our stereotype of why we think these acts occur. The other thing that was interesting is it's often very young, very often by the age of 15. So I was really curious about why that was happening. We're talking in many cases boys. I mean, I've been a teacher, I've been a parent, I've worked with teenagers. I'm thinking we all play a part in creating a teenager with that sort of mentality.
What do you think? Those three answers are so... I don't even know what to say about
it. It's hard
them.
To know where to start when somebody says they're entitled or they were bored.
Or it was fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
All three of them are unbelievable. But what do you know from all of, or have you gathered from all of your research? What do you feel is beneath that?
Well, it seems like a couple of things. One is cultures where you have very strong gender disparity, men and boys feel entitled to essentially be the dominant gender. Mm-hmm. And as they become men, as they become older, they have incorporated this notion that that's what it means to be a man, is essentially to be dominant over women. And if you think about all the implications of that, that can be pretty serious. So one of the things is if you have really high gender disparities, you're getting these notions of that dominance is what it means to be a man. And obviously that can lead to some pretty unpleasant consequences if that mentality goes awry.
Right.
So it's a sense of entitlement, and you see it in other cultures as well.
So when you've traveled so much, since a pretty young age.
I was
you were in the
21.
Peace Corps.
I was in Peace Corps, right, in right. West Africa, before mm-hmm. cell phones, before the internet.
And that was at, what, 21?
21, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you've actually lived in seven countries.
Including the U.S., correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
So from your perspective of all these different countries, what are some of the challenges that you've faced, whether living there or traveling in other countries as a woman, from a gender standpoint?
Sure, sure. To be fair, sometimes it's hard to pull out because you're by definition a foreigner, and so you're treated also as a foreigner. I think some of the things that I've experienced as a woman, sometimes you're hassled, there's no question. Sometimes you do feel you're hassled, then you do feel it has a gender basis, whether it's just being stared at on the street, whether it's being followed, whether it's remarks that really are unwanted, whether it's some physical groping, that sort of thing. You can experience that, and you definitely feel it's gender-oriented. What's interesting is sometimes you're just sort of ignored. I noticed this in India where I would sort of, you're essentially not really listened to. They really want a man somehow, especially in public places, dealing with officials, dealing with bureaucracy. I used to kid every once in a while. I'd have to say to my husband, you know, you call these people. They're not listening to me. Because sometimes you would definitely feel that you're essentially not really of any importance to them. You're ignored. And that's an interesting, it's subtle, but it has a very insidious effect over time.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. Now, to be fair, I certainly don't experience the kinds of vulnerability or violence that many women living in these countries do. I mean, there's no question, obviously. Indian women, for example, have a whole different basket of social cultural expectations.
So,
and I'm obviously a foreigner, so those don't apply to me.
But let's take India. So did you dress in traditional Indian clothing, or did you wear
often?
You wear
I would.
Here?
It was a mix. It depended a lot where I was going and what I wanted to do. I mean, obviously, many Indian women do also wear more Western dress, so you will see flux. It's not like everyone is dressed in a sari, and I don't wear saris; they're not very comfortable. Yeah. But salwar kameez, which is a very Indian dress, I would wear that to a lot of places. Absolutely, it's also comfortable. It's very hot in India, and it's very comfortable.
Yeah.
So some of it's practicality, but I would. But there would be other times where, you know, I'm a Western woman. I like my shorts. I want to wear what I want to wear. And you definitely have to think about that. You have to decide, do you want to be stared at? And that's fine. You can wear your shorts outside. It may not be pleasant. So it's not like you can be neutral.
So you can wear the shorts, but you're just going to, you know,
have some ramifications.
You have to accept how people might view you or treat you or interpret that. And again, so you can choose how to use it. If you want to do that for your own physical comfort or you're willing for that, but people interpret things in very different ways in different cultures. And that's, we sometimes forget in America, but it's not just, hey, it's hot out, so I'm wearing my shorts, which is what you might think in America. It has extremely different connotations, matters of dress. We're very liberal about that in this country. You can practically wear anything anywhere.
Right.
Much of the world is not. You know, dress codes of certain things convey messages of class or status or position, and we sometimes forget that. So you just have to be very mindful of it. You can choose what to do, but you have to think about it differently.
Right. Yeah. So I was thinking about the play, Spoiled, mm-hmm. and I mean, I don't have daughters, but I can imagine what I would want to teach my daughter or a young woman, my niece, for instance, about, you know, being careful, protecting herself. But what is our responsibility as parents and teachers of boys in a way to teach them or guide them or help them to be better men?
Mm-hmm. I think it's very important we teach both similar messages. And boys and girls are very different, there's no question. But I think it's important that they both get similar messages, that we don't perpetuate this notion of a dominant gender, whether they're 10 or 12 or 15, that we create more egalitarian dialogue is the way I like to think of it. And sometimes that starts at very early ages and it creeps in. And I would say one other thing that from the research we found is that notions of gender start very, very, very early. And by the time you're a teenager, you've incorporated a great deal, whatever society you're in. So right. if you're a parent or a teacher, say, and you're working with a young child and you see or experience really gender-directed behavior or words, often it's language, call it out when they're young. It's okay to be aware of it. Don't just think, oh, well, they're little. It doesn't matter.
So practically,
So I'll give you an example.
So
very often, especially with young children, so if people would greet a small boy, you know, very often you get a high buddy or it's a fist bump or they're going to high five or something like that. And a little girl, typically the comment would be about her clothing. She might get a hug, but almost invariably someone would say, oh, you look so cute. You look so pretty. Nice shoes. People think they're being lovely. They think they're being wonderful. But think about the different messages about communication, and that's repeated over and over again. And it says things. Again, nobody wants to feel sort of like they're harping on every little social interaction, but research has shown that those things do make a difference cumulatively. So it's very important to think, you know, are we encouraging boys also, for example, to talk about feelings? You know, is that okay? Do we only really give approval to boys who fit a masculine standard of sort of sports and physique and dominance, that sort of thing? And very often we do. We subliminally prefer that in a boy, and boys who are a little quieter, more sensitive. In our culture, they have a tough time very often. You know, gender inequities hurt both boys and girls. It's a myth we're just trying to kind of improve girls. It hurts both genders. I'll give you one other example. It's very often in schools, you will see in classrooms, boys will be the dominant speakers. It has nothing to do with education or class or anything. Boys will be the dominant speakers, and that perpetuates all the way up through the workforce. Sheryl Sandberg, who wrote this book called Lean In, talks about it in the boardroom. It still happens.
Right.
So that's very important. If girls learn that they're sort of have the second class voice and the dominant voice, the primary person is the boy or the male, those are very pervasive things. So I think people should be aware of them early on. Encourage boys and girls to speak equally. Try to draw out a boy if he's quiet. Don't let him override a girl who's speaking, for example, if she's maybe stops talking as soon as he starts talking. All those little interactions make a difference over time.
It almost seems like we're brainwashed, you know, into those gender stereotypes.
It's one of the few categories that's still acceptable. Again, if you think about schools, we're often still doing things girls and boys. We always talk about the girls and the boys.
Right.
You know, people would never say, well, the blue-eyed children and the brown-eyed children. They wouldn't say the black children and the white children. I mean, most of this we say instantly, well, of course you wouldn't divide them that way. But boys and girls, kids learn that is a gender distinction to pay attention to. That's a distinction, rather, to pay attention to. That's what matters. You're a boy or a girl. And obviously it's not going to go away. It's wonderful. The point is not to change being, you know, men or women. Right. It's to create a more egalitarian platform for both sides.
But it's interesting what you said, how it continues on into the boardroom, so to speak, yeah. or into our work life, being interrupted and being the one, and I know this is true even of myself, being the one who kind of steps back or sits
sure.
back or doesn't
sure.
join
sure.
the circle
sure.
of the
sure.
table as readily.
Right, and if girls and women think that they sort of don't have an equal place, it's very hard for those equal conversations to take place. And again, some studies have shown that it's sort of not exactly helpful for boys and men either. You sometimes get risk-taking behavior that isn't particularly helpful because men or boys might have a tendency to dominate a conversation, and that doesn't always lead to good outcomes. You need both perspectives very often for big decisions.
So right.
You want to hear them.
So we're talking about each individual, and then I'm going to expand it to the city level. And I know you're working on an incredibly important project.
It is, yes.
Called CEDAW.
CEDAW,
so you just explain
yes.
that.
Okay, CEDAW, C-E-D-A-W, is the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. I did not invent that. That is an international convention. And it has been accepted. It was first actually signed by President Carter. So we're talking many
wow.
years ago.
In the 70s.
It's exactly. It's been accepted by most countries in the world have all signed it and ratified it, with the exception of 7 countries. Only 7 have not signed it. And that includes the Sudan and places like that. We are one of those 7 that the
wow.
U.S. has not approved this. And in itself, the convention simply says that signatories will take steps to eliminate discrimination across all walks of life. That's all. Just says we're going to level the playing field. So at the moment, there's an initiative to have cities and localities in the U.S. take on this with local ordinances. So, for example, the city of Los Angeles, Louisville, Kentucky, San Francisco, they've gone to their local governments and said, wait a minute, we can have this at a local level. We all live here locally. Let's just stop discrimination here and let's look at see what we're doing. Do we have equal employment? Do we have equal pay? That sort of thing. So we have a campaign to have Sarasota become a CEDAW city. And Sarasota actually has some non-discrimination ordinances already on file, which is fantastic. So now we're looking at them to see what we really can do to add our wonderful city to the ranks of CEDAW cities. We're hoping for 100 by 2016.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what does each city have to agree to?
They essentially agree that the big picture is they agree to take steps to eliminate discrimination. And then there's a whole bunch of areas they should look through. For example, public housing, transportation, education, public employment, that sort of thing. So cities that take it on fully really do a little bit of a survey of those things and say, are there ways in which we are not being gender neutral in all these areas of city life and all the municipal things that affect them? And they take steps, obviously, to mitigate them. It's very city-specific, depending on what their issues are.
So, but who kind of does the checking?
It has to be within the city government. Outside agencies, there are many other NGOs, and I should say those are non-governmental organizations. There are many, many that have agreed to this on a national level. Many peace and justice committees of religious organizations, American Association of University Women, many other organizations have really looked at this and said, this will help us all. This will help the whole community. So some cities, it's a basket of non-governmental organizations that play kind of a monitoring role. And in other cases, there's an organization right within the city.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
How long do you think before it will come into effect?
Well, we're meeting next week, so a lot of it will depend on the city government here. So we'll see.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
Stay tuned.
So one of the places that I was interested in, you've been into so many interesting places, India. There's a place called Holy Family.
There is.
Tell me about that place and your role
okay.
there.
When I went in 2011, I knew I wanted to use some of my volunteer time to work with girls and women. One of the things I had done before was teach. I felt I could contribute some in that way, and I found this orphanage. It's actually called a shelter home in India, but it's an orphanage for girls called Holy Family Ashaniwas, which really means House of Hope. It is run by Catholic nuns of the Order of Holy Family, and they house from 40 to 50 girls. So I started going there, working on English with the girls after school, and and it sort of grew from there. So the next thing you knew, we were working on computer skills and we were working on after-school training and that sort of thing. Many of these girls have no family members in the picture. Some of them do. Some of them might have family members who can't care for them because of illness or poverty. And they're all in school, so they all have to stay in a formal school. But I was their tutor, their little bit of a window on the outside world, and I also developed a friendship with the sisters, the nuns who worked there, who were extremely dedicated to helping these girls. And it's a great place.
It sounds wonderful. So gender equality, I just want to get back to this for one moment. What can, I mean, each of our listeners, I'm sure, would like to be able to do something towards gender equality. What are some practical ways that we can kind of facilitate that in our own lives?
Sure. Well, the first step, obviously, is being aware. As we've mentioned, some of these things, they just become part and parcel of our culture. We don't see them. So first, you really need to put on your sort of awareness lens. If you have children or you work with children, start early, start often. Small things matter. It's a myth that you only have to do large things, join organizations, go on marches. Those are all great if you want to do it. But we are all, in some way, with children in our world. So it's very important to start early. Be aware of all those gender inconsistencies. Are you modeling ones that you want your children to repeat, or you want children in your lives, or you just want young people around you, whether they're in a shop or wherever they are? I'll give you another example that sometimes people are very get hung up on little things like opening doors for other people. And, you know, very often boys used to be told, you know, hold a door for a girl,
right,
or if you're going someplace to look out to protect a girl. You know, I hate to say it, but I'm not a fan of either of those. I'm all for politeness and mutual respect, but those two messages say essentially that the girl is really dependent on protection or assistance, and the boy is really, or the man is really, the one who has to take care and manage the outside environment. I think it's okay to say, look out for one another. If you're at the door first, hold the door for the person. They can be gender-neutral courtesies that show mutual respect.
Right.
Girls can hold the door for boys in a simple one. If you're going out with a number of people, especially young people, look out for one another. It doesn't just have to be sort of the dominant boy that is the protector. I think it's those notions that will help us change it to mutual respect, mutual conversation, and not a skewed relationship, which, again, doesn't particularly help men either.
Right. I really appreciate that, because sometimes it's the practical things that,
sure,
you know, every day, day in and day out, that we do that we don't even think about. Excuse me. So as a result of the play Spoiled and the work that you've been doing with Spoiled and the work that you've been doing really that has been incredible all over the world, what is your greatest wish for the outcome of your contribution?
Well, what I do is small, so I don't have overinflated notions. However, I think everybody can make a difference in their small way. I would really love to see greater cross-cultural understanding. I think that really applies to so much as cross-cultural. Obviously, that affects genders, but, you know, if we would just have a little more understanding of how other people would do things in the world, so many things spring from that. We
right.
realize our way is not the only way. We get out of our bubble. We get a broader perspective on things, and many useful, healthy behaviors flow from that. I think it also makes us feel more fulfilled. It helps us self-direct better. But I think if we could just have more cross-cultural understanding, that would really go a long way to making a better world.
So how do you recommend people do that? One, I know you travel.
Travel.
Right?
Travel is good. Travel is good, and, you know, I think people can travel perhaps more easily than they think. I think we're sometimes subliminally afraid to. I realize, you know, we all have time limitations and work and financial limitations, but we do have some time. You know, many of us do have some money that we can do. We're often a little bit afraid to get out of our comfort zone.
Right.
Many, many people go on cruises, for example. I think that's the most common thing. Cruises are wonderful. Cruises don't always take people outside their comfort zone, and I think that's where life really starts to happen. So I would encourage people, you know, once in a while, take some of that money that you might spend on maybe a safer trip to Disney or to the cruise. Take one that's a little outside your comfort zone. The world is not such a dangerous place. The world is a wonderful place, and it'll really change a lot in your life just from any small trips. So I guess that's one big thing I would encourage.
I love that. So then maybe that is your juicy secret. I don't know, but if you had one juicy secret to living a happy and successful life, What would it be?
Well, certainly cross-cultural. I don't have just one. I'm sorry, Rachel.
That's okay. That's all right. You're allowed to have
one. You know,
a lot
of the ones that have been around for a long time that are not secrets really make a difference in terms of valuing other people, getting outside ourselves. I'll tell you one thing. I'm a big believer in creating our lives, not just finding something. We tell people to find their passion. I don't believe that. I think we create it. We make it up as we go along. There is no such thing as failure. You have twists and turns, and you will have twists and turns your whole life. And if you just take the view that that's part of the grand scheme of life and there's probably good that comes from it, I think it changes your whole perspective on challenges and on life, and that helps. But I'm a secret believer in nature, too. Get out in nature as much as you can. Mm. That's very helpful.
I love it. I am so grateful for all the work that you've done already and all the work that you're doing
Thank
in
you.
The world, and
Thank
it's really
you.
A pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us
on the Red Couch.
I'm the happy girl. Everybody knows that the sweetest thing that you ever see in the whole wide world is a happy girl. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. I'm the happy girl.
Who's coming in town?
Bradford Lee Folk and the Bluegrass Playboys.
Where is he playing?
At the Forgeyville Community Media and Arts Center.
What kind of music?
They'll be playing Good Times Bluegrass music. Bradford Lee Folk is an organic farmer by day and a bluegrass picker by night.
And a magic sent them from above. A wing of an owl, a shot falls from the sky.
When will he be playing?
Wednesday, July 15th at 7 p.m.
How much?
$12 in advance and $15 at the door.
Where can I get more information?
Go to WSLR.org or call 894-6469.
I'll be there.
Yeah.
When you find out that it's long gone.
A pretty ballad now with Wes Montgomery, a portrait of Jenny.